This is Muriel McMahon, April 13th, 2012. Unlocking the Past and Healing Ancestral Complexes.
I had the pleasure of meeting and co-creating ceremony with Muriel in the beautiful mountains of North Carolina. And Muriel is a very special woman, analyst, and grandmother. And I'm just thrilled to have her here, and I know all of you will feel free and or freer with her here. I'd like to read to you a poem that I found on Muriel's newly revised website that really touched me, and I just thought it would be a nice introduction to her work. The breeze at dawn has secrets to tell you. Don't go back to sleep. You must ask for what you really want. Don't go back to sleep. People are going back and forth across the door sill where the two worlds touch. The door is round and open. Don't go back to sleep. Rumi. Muriel is a Zurich-trained Jungian analyst and an indigenous elder in the Algonquin Kipewa tradition. She resides and practices in Ontario, in Guelph, near Toronto, and she lectures internationally. So welcome, Muriel McMahon.
Sago Gananoa. Sago Gananoa, we meet again, for surely we have already met in the dream time. In my tradition, that's how we begin, because we have known one another. We have known one another, we would not be gathered here together tonight. So I say to you, Sago Gananoa, we meet again. I have received a lovely welcome to Seattle, and the weather notwithstanding. This is what I'm beginning to believe. You know, you wouldn't, you know, back east, the rumors are that it's rainy here all the time. That certainly hasn't been the case today. It's been absolutely beautiful. How are we doing? Good? I have received a lovely introduction by Mary Allison, by Bunny. Bunny, yes? But I must begin in the way of my people. And the way of my people is that we begin by introducing from whom we have come. Because what happens when we speak of who our people are, that they dip just a little closer to us and they begin to listen. And they perhaps say, maybe tonight, maybe in this place, maybe at this time, the forgotten stories will begin to be told. And maybe, just maybe, that all that forgetting about what it means to be a village and what it means to be a people, that we will begin to remember. And in that remembering, we will begin to live again. Begin to live not for ourselves, but for the old ones. And for those who will come after us. There is a greeting in the, I believe it comes from the northwest coast, and it's a greeting that I can't speak the sacredness of the words, but I can translate what it means. And it's a greeting that is only delivered between the very old and the very young. And it's a greeting in translation that says, ah, my replacement. Because only the very young know the place that the old ones are going. And the old ones know the place where the young one has come from. And so the exchange is, ah, my replacement. So the work that I am passionate about as a Jungian analyst and as an Indigenous grandmother is to work not for individuation's sake, but to see individuation as a vehicle to work for a time I will not see, to work for the generations that will follow me. And so when I talk about ancestral complexes or when I talk about ancestral work, I'm talking about what I have inherited, what is my legacy, and the burden that I didn't ask for, yet I pick up and carry. And I am working in such a way that what I will leave behind for my descendants hopefully will be pearls and not rocks. One of my teachers talks about the last third of our lives, and as I look around the room, I can suspect that some of you know what I'm talking about when I talk about the last third of our lives. And it's when we're no longer compelled by the competency addiction. We are no longer just trying to prove ourselves. We've proven ourselves. We've paid the rent. And we're here and we have something to offer. So the last third of our lives is gathering up those stones of regret, gathering them up and polishing them with our tears and with our hands and polishing them so that our dying not be another stone of regret, but rather we will gather up those stones and we will perhaps create a cairn where we place those stones, those things that were so difficult when they happened, and we littered them on the path, and maybe if we had a good analysis, we gathered them up and we put them in a basket and we knew them for what they were. But the last third of our lives is about taking those stones and polishing them to be the jewels that they are and building the cairn so that our dying itself might be the pearl of wisdom that we place on the very top with our last breath. And just before that last breath, we look out at the landscape and we see that what we have left for our descendants is a path of beauty rather than a quarry of unmined stones. So that's what I'm working toward, and that's what I believe in, and that's what I'm passionate about. So what I will be doing tonight and what we will be doing together tomorrow is we will begin to speak not of the dead, but to the dead. Not of the ancestors, but to the ancestors. And I have two teachers. One teacher is an Indigenous Mohawk woman, and she speaks of the ancestors as if it were some generic term, and that it holds wisdom, and that the ancestors have the truths that we are seeking. And I believe there is truth in that. I believe that my experience in her lodge has taught me that that is so. But I also have another teacher who looks like me, and he comes from elsewhere. And he speaks of our need to know my ancestors, for you to know your ancestors. And in knowing your ancestors, if you've come from elsewhere, as most of us have, then there is a legacy of lostness. There is a legacy of trauma. And I remember when I was first in his teaching place and he was asking us to go to Europe with the teachings, and he was taking us to Europe with the history, and I was bored to tears. I could barely keep my eyes open, and I was blaming it on, you know, he doesn't believe in giving us a pee break, and what's the matter with him, and, oh, it's too hot, and it's too uncomfortable, and I was blaming it on that. But what I was really experiencing was the resistance in my ancestral line to return to the place where the suffering began. And to claim not only the romantic ancestors that is my maternal heritage, but to also claim the colonizing ancestors that were my paternal heritage. and know both sides of the story, the vowed and the disavowed. So tonight I invite the ancestors to come, the ancestors that are of this place and of this land, but also the ancestors who have been homeless for generations. And I invite them to come. So I tell you that my name is Muriel Elaine McMahon, and that my father's people came to Nova Scotia. They came from Scotland, and they came from Ireland. And before that, they came from other places. And so I have the indigenous tradition of the Celtic running through my blood. My name is Wolfsong Talakanti in my maternal tradition. And my mother's people come from Temiskaming, from Kippewa, from Mattawa, from the traditions of First Nation. So I name myself in that fullness to invite those ancestors to come. So I ask you, as you hear this, just to open in your own imagination, open in your own mind to who you are, who you come from. There's a greeting that comes from, I believe it's South America, and the greeting is, when you see someone, you say, "How is your face blooming on the ancestral trunk?" You know, like, how's, you know, that's a lot better than "How's it going for you?" You know, how is your face blooming on the ancestral trunk? Who are your people? Who are all your people? I convened a panel in Montreal during the IAAP Congress, the last IAAP Congress. We gathered together Indigenous healers and Jungian analysts to create a dialogue between the ways we look at dreams and the ways that we look at healing and the ways that we can meet and the ways that we can't meet. And it was a profound gathering. And it took a lot to actually have a dialogue and not just have a series of monologues. Because I don't know about you, but usually panel discussions are just that. They're not a discussion. They're a monologue. Everyone gets, you know, 7 minutes to, you know, say their thing. But we really struggled to have a dialogue together. And by the last day that happened, we were gathered in a room that was too small, because it's like as word got out, more and more people came. I'm not seeing any familiar faces. Was anyone at that was in this group? No, I'm not recognizing any faces. Boy, did you miss an event. And I'm going to tell you about it so you don't have to worry about missing it. So we were gathered, and in that last panel discussion, it was about 3 minutes to 4 o'clock. And we'd been at it for however long a session is. I can't remember. It felt like 3 hours, but I'm sure it was maybe two. So it was just about over, and the place was buzzing. Something had shifted, and in they came. It's like that doorway that Mary Alice spoke to was wide open, and they were streaming in. And I'm not talking about the analysts that were gathered at the Congress. I'm talking about the old ones. They're saying, "Boy, something's happening at a Jungian conference that we're actually interested in." And they started pouring in. And my colleague who was helping to organize the panel with me was Peter Amon, and he's very Swiss. And for anyone who studied in Switzerland, you know exactly what I mean. They made the clocks. They know preciseness. And so Peter's just about ready to have a bird because, you know, looks like we're going to run overtime and the place is buzzing and I've got the microphone. And so he's looking at his watch and he's looking at me and he's looking at his watch and he's looking at me because, like, he's beginning to panic. And so recognizing his stress, and so I suggested to the group, which was people were popping up with questions and comments, I suggested that the story isn't over. And let's allow the story to continue. And let's continue to talk about what started here, you know, over dinner and the next day and the next week and the next year, etc. And one of the members of the panel said, well, why do we have to stop? It's 4 o'clock. There's no one who needs the room after us. Why don't we just let those who really need to go leave? No one's held captive, but those who want to stay, let's just stay. So you know what happens when you that time outside of time. So now it's after 4 o'clock, and only about 3 or 4 people left, and my Swiss colleague was not one of them, but he was more relieved because we had made a decision. And so we were speaking, and people were sharing, and the moment that we had labored toward, and the moment I have been laboring toward in my work with the ancestral and the work with the link between the Jungian and the ancestral, was a woman stood up and with tears, because she was so in her story, she said that she had Chakao ancestry and that it was a legacy that she had grown up ashamed of. And that because of the dialogue that had opened, she felt the presence of those ancestors welcomed in that moment. And you could just feel the goosebumps. You could just feel that something important had happened. And that would have been worth the price of admission. But that wasn't all. She continued. She said, I also have ancestry who were the perpetrators of the crimes against the indigenous people of this continent. And they, too, are here. So to bring together the avowed and the disavowed, and to feel some sense of resolution, or at least some sense of let's start talking together and finding out what it's about, occurred in that moment. And that's when I knew that this is where we're going. This is where we're going as a people. This is where we're going as Jungians. That this is what Jung with the Red Book showed us how to do. I mean, read the Red Book, folks. I mean, the ancestral is all over that. You can call it an act of imagination, or you can say the last part of it is the sermons to the dead. Like, clearly, in my humble opinion, that's really what we are being led toward. And that's why it took all the time it took for the Red Book to come to us, because we had to be ready. And I believe we're ready. And the gathering here tonight perhaps suggests some of that. So I'm going to read you a poem. I'm going to read you a poem by a man that I have fallen in love with. And he belongs to you. He's an American. Drew Dellinger. A beautiful man. He came to Guelph, and my friend had sponsored him, and I had so much to do, and I didn't think I needed to go to another event, and I'd buy his book, and I'll pay, but I won't go, but I went out of a sense of obligation, and he had me at the first word, and I have been singing his praises whenever I can. But I want you to listen to this poem that I've chosen tonight called... I think it's on the next slide. I've written it, or I put it down on a slide for you so you can, check it out. And perhaps this is my apology to him for a public performance of his poem. And please buy his book, Love Letters to the Milky Way. But the poem that I'd like to read is Ancestors and Angels. So I encourage you to hear this and to be heard by it. Would have helped if I remembered my glasses. The third half of life. Ancestors and Angels. I write words to catch up to the ancestors. An angel told me the only way to walk through fire without getting burned is to become fire. Some days angels whisper in my ear as I walk down the street and I fall in love with every person I meet. And I think, maybe this could be a bliss like when Dante met Beatrice. Other days, all I see is my collusion with illusion. ghosts of projections masquerading as the radiant angel of love. You know, I feel like the ancestors brought us together. I feel like the ancestors brought us here, and they expect great things. I believe the ancestors have brought us here, and they expect great things. They expect us to say what we think and live how we feel and follow the hard paths that bring us near joy. They expect us to nurture all the children. I write poems to welcome angels and to conjure ancestors. Poems to welcome angels and conjure ancestors. I pray to the angels of politics and love. I pray for justice's sake not to be relieved of my frustrations, at the same time burning sage and asking the ancestors for patience. I march with the people to the border between the nations where everything stops except the greed of the corporations. Thoughts like comets, calculating the complexity of the complicity. The complexity of the complicity. There is so much noise in the ocean. The whales can't hear each other. We're making them crazy, driving dolphins insane. What kind of ancestors are we? Thoughts like comets leaving craters in the landscape of my consciousness. I pray to ancestors and angels. Meet me in the garden. Meet me where spirit walks softly in the cool of the evening. Meet me in the garden under the wings of the bird of many colors. Meet me in the garden of your longing. Every breath is a pilgrimage. Every breath is a pilgrimage to you. I pray to be a conduit. An angel told me. An ancestor told me. The only way to walk through fire, become fire. Drew Dellinger, Love Letter to the Milky Way. If I ever have a school, or God help me, an institute, the syllabus will be Jung's Red Book, Jung's Answer to Job, and everything Leonard Cohen ever wrote. I'm going to play Leonard Cohen for you. Have you seen him recently? I mean, God, talk about the last third of your life. Maybe it's the last fifth. I don't know. But I tell you, he's polishing jewels for sure. What does he say? He says he's only got four notes and they just keep getting lower. We were talking about setting up the AV for this, and I was getting emails about, you know, my slides, and I'm thinking, oh, I guess they want slides. Okay, I'll throw them a bone. I'll give them some slides. And so I sent some slides, and Tom was kind enough to copy them to his laptop, so we have slides. But what I really wanted was to play this song by Leonard Cohen. If you don't have his new album, get it. It's phenomenal. But as you listen to it, what I want you to just ask yourself is, who is speaking? Who is speaking? So I threatened that if they couldn't somehow set up the AV where we could listen to Leonard Cohen, that I would sing it.
I'd like to speak to Leonard.
So I'm going to let Leonard Cohen sing it.
He's a sportsman and a shepherd. He's a lazy bastard living in a suit. But he does say what I tell him, even though it isn't welcome. He just doesn't have the freedom to refuse. He will speak these words of wisdom like a sage, a man of vision, though he knows he's really nothing but a brief elaboration of a tube. Going home without my sorrow, going home sometime tomorrow, going home to where it's better than before. Going home without my burden, going home behind the curtain, going home without the costume that I wore. He wants to write a love song, an anthem of forgiving, a manual with defeat. A cry above the suffering, a sacrifice recovering, but that isn't what I need him to complete. I want him to be certain that he doesn't have a burden, that he doesn't need a vision, that he only has permission to do my instant bidding, which is to say what I have told him to repeat. Going home without my sorrow, going home sometime tomorrow, going home to where it's better than before. Going home without my burden, going home behind the curtain, going home costume that I wore.
Drew Dellinger, but we've got Leonard Cohen. I mean, you know, so when we open to the ancestral, you know, I want to write a love song, an anthem of forgiveness, but that isn't what I need him to complete. So what you want, what you believe your work is, gets reconfigured when you open to the ancestral, and you will hear what your work is. You will hear what you're being asked to carry, and then you make a conscious choice of whether or not you're going to carry that, whether or not you're going to polish that jewel. That's what I believe happens. And I'm a testament to it. The About 2 years ago, my husband and I started going up to this little parcel of land in a remote corner of Ontario. And we would be up there for the weekend, and then we would be talking on Sunday about whether we would leave after lunch. And then the next time, whether we would leave after dinner. And the next time, who's the first person you're seeing on Monday, and what time do you have to be there? You know, so we kept getting, it kept getting longer. We didn't know what it was that was calling to us, because we didn't really have anywhere to go. We didn't really have anyone to see, but there was just something calling us. And in December, we were driving up there for the weekend, and we got about 45 minutes from our destination, and we looked at each other and said, "What is it about this place? It's like we wake up when we're here. It's like the ancestral that is not only two-legged begins to speak to us, the trees and the animals and the rocks." And so we started that weekend dreaming out loud. Well, what would it be like if? And on the 1st of April, we moved to our new home in this little remote corner of the province. Closed a successful analytical practice, said goodbye to friends and family, two grandsons, and we moved 5 or 6 hours away. And all we know at this point is that it's an ancestral call, that there is something that is leading us, something that has called us, and that's why we're there. So while I encourage you to open to the ancestral, I also warn you that when you open to the ancestral, it's like, you know, when you stumble into the analytical office because you think you've got an issue in a relationship and you find that that's what got you to the analyst's office, but that's not why you're there. And so the same is true of the ancestral call, but I believe the ancestral call is bigger than individuation. I believe it's a kind of individuating of the collective soul. It's an individuating of the group soul. It's an individuating of the tribe. It's like psyche doesn't know we still don't live in tribes. And when you start to open to it and you start to dream one another's dreams and you start to see that sometimes you receive a dream for someone else, then you begin to recognize the connections, the tribal connections, the ancestral connections. And my Jungian mind has an explanation for that, and my indigenous way of being has an explanation for that. And they're not at cross purposes. I think it's just different language. So what I'd like to do right now is I'm going to start. Kind of been starting for a while. I'm going to start the way that I begin every day. I'm going to start with my river song. And I'm going to play the river song because it really is an opening to the four directions. And this was a song that was gifted to me. It came to me in my dream, and that this is the way that it would be, and this is how you will start every day. And I've been doing that for many years. And then I'm going to tell you the story of how I came to the ancestral through my own dreaming, through my own Jungian work, and how I use that in my practice as well. So I'm going to invite you to find your own drum, which is your heartbeat. So you can just hold your hand on your heart, because really that is what makes us a tribe. That is the heartbeat of the mother. That is the heartbeat of the earth. And you can feel it and know that you can join in that rhythm. So if you want to, you know, kind of go along with me, you can. Thank you. To the next slide. This is Snowdrop. And I'm going to tell you the story about Snowdrop's incarnation. I started a Jungian analyst. I started a Jungian analysis after 5 years of working with a Jungian-oriented psychotherapist, where I was working on the grief over the death of my husband. And so when I went into this Jungian-orientated psychotherapist's office and he asked me if I had any dreams, I thought, well, yeah, I want to be a principal someday and I want to get over this grief. And he said, no, like, do you have any dreams? And it was like, well, yeah, but who wants to hear my dreams? And so I was hooked because it resonated so clearly as a way to find my own path to my healing. So I worked with him for about 5 years. And then I began to, I'd got my life back on track and I had made some significant changes and I'd learned to carry the grief. And you don't get over grief, you just learn to carry it. You just learn to, it's a skill and you get really good at it after a while. And then I started having dreams, and these dreams were about studying to be a Jungian analyst. And that was absolutely ridiculous. I mean, I was a high school principal, and I didn't want to be a therapist, and I was seeing a Jungian-oriented psychotherapist, not an analyst. So I decided I would start a Jungian analysis with the expressed desire to see the symbolic nature of these dreams so that I didn't have to see the literal nature of these dreams, that I would see them as, oh, it's about how to live your life symbolically. It's not about training to be an analyst. So I started to work with a Jungian analyst. And after, maybe 2 or 3 months in, she said to me, have you ever been to Kusnak? And I said, are you still speaking English? I didn't even know what Kusnak was. And I'm not even sure I'm pronouncing it right. But she said, because that dream describes the arrivals platform in Kusnak. So part of your psyche is already there. And so clearly it was something more literal that was leading me to Switzerland, because I ended up, after trying to convince myself otherwise, I ended up becoming a Jungian analyst, training in Zurich to become a Jungian analyst. So I could see that what I wanted to be symbolic actually had a literal quality to it, and that was the nature of my analysis. Then what happened is I started to have these dreams, And these dreams were about a Native woman in a logger's cabin giving a premature birth to a child, and both her and the child dying. And it sounded like something for a really good story, and I like to write, so I thought, okay, what's coming to me now is a novel. What's coming to me now is a story. So my analyst encouraged me to start to write the story of the dream, and I'd get a little bit more of it. It was like the dream maker was giving me this story. So I faithfully would sit down and write it. Well, I remember having a strong dream, and it was during what in my traditions we call the ghost dance time, which is the time between the end of October and the first part of November, when the veils between the worlds are quite thin and the dead are walking amongst us, as if they're not all the time, but it's a time when perhaps the haze that covers our collusion with the illusion eases a bit. And so I went into what can best be described as a writing reverie. And for about 3 days, it was all I could do to just keep my fingers on the keyboard. And I would stop and sleep when I had to. And I when I read Jung's Red Book, I got a sense of some of what he was talking about, where you just are haunted by the images that are coming forth from the unconscious, and you feel a little like you're going mad. But if you can give it form and contain it some way, then the meaning will show itself. So that's what I started to do, and I ended up writing what I guess could be called a novel called The Ancient Ones. And they were stories that came to me through this writing reverie. And one story was the story of Agnes. And Agnes was this indigenous woman who gave birth to a child in a logger's cabin. So I shared it with my analyst, and I talked about, you know, maybe editing it one day and getting it published and becoming rich and famous and not having to be an analyst that way. And because, you know, you can become rich and famous as an analyst, but it's really hard. So I was exploring that as a possibility. And about a year after I wrote The Ancient Ones, I shared it with my mother. And she read it and came to me just like with a deer caught in the headlight. And she said, "You've written some of my story." And, "Well, what do you mean?" And she said, "Well, there's a family secret. And the family secret is that her mother was an indigenous woman, and that my grandfather was a logger, and he had taken his wife and his two children into the bush, and he would go off and he would log, and then he would come back, and my grandmother went into labor prematurely, and both her and the baby died. And my mother and my uncle were found. They don't know whether it was 3 days or 5 days. It just depends on exactly when she had died. And they were eating cold oatmeal off the floor that the 4-year-old was able to get for the 2-year-old. And so that was the story. And then my uncle and my mother were taken in by my paternal grandmother and raised a French-Canadian Catholic. And the legacy or the indigenous background was something to be denied and something that was shameful. So what was happening in my dreaming is that these untold stories, these lost stories, were surfacing. And because of my commitment to the dreaming through the analytical process, and because of my willingness to open to the unconscious, yet give it form in the writing, and you can give it form in dance, and you can give it form in art, and you can give it form in sculpture. There are many ways to give it form, but to give it form so that its truth can then show itself. That's what happened, and that's what basically gave birth to this drum. So a while later, it was many years later, I decided as I started to, my mother and I together started to reclaim our indigenous roots and to trace who our people were and to trace the stories and to begin to honor the stories. And I started to study with some indigenous teachers so I could learn my past. I could learn the stories that were not part of my growing up because my mother was not raised in a traditional manner, obviously. And then I decided that I wanted to make a Native hand drum. So I had studied enough to know how to do that, and so my husband helped me stretch the skin on the form, and the teaching is then you hang it in a cedar tree overnight, and then you birth it at dawn, and then the drum will announce its name and sing its first song, and it's very much a living thing, it's a living being, it's an ancestor. And so I had the idea that because I was a Jungian analyst, I wanted my drum to be birthed on the longest night. And so it would hold the energy of that dark night of the soul. It would hold the energy of the longest night. And so when I gave birth to it at solstice, that perhaps that depth and that awakening would somehow be in her song. So I'm from Ontario, Canada. It was a pretty cold night as we climbed up and tied her into the cedar tree. And I went to sleep and set the alarm because I'm not quite into those rhythms yet to be able to just get up knowing the sun's about to rise. And I cut her out of the cedar tree and I brought her into the house and she was all warped and loose and stillborn. And I wept because, you know, and then, you know, the old track gets going. Oh, well, who do you think you are? You know, you don't have enough red blood in you to have a Native hand drum. And, you know, you should have had some indigenous elder show you how to do it and yada, yada, yada. All these things because I had given birth to a stillborn drum and she would never have a song. And at that moment, I hadn't made the connection back to my ancestral. But what I did is I took her to bed with me. I mean, it was still dark out. So I took her, I went back to bed, and I just pulled the covers over my head, and I held her against my belly, and I fell asleep into a deep sleep. And there was no dream. And when I woke up about 45 minutes or an hour later, I had to peel her off my belly, and she was taut, and she was tight, and she had a song, and she was not stillborn. And so she announced her name, and her name is Snowdrop, because the snowdrops are those first blooms that push through the frozen ground and remind us that something is waking up. And so I know she is my ancestor. I know that through the drum, the voice of that one who was still born in that cabin is told again. And that every time I tell the story, that ancestral energy lives again. So when I talk about telling the ancestral story, I'm not talking about a reiterating story. I'm not talking about a story about my grandfather did this or my great-grandfather did that. I'm talking about telling the stories so that they can live. And those living stories become the living legacy. And so I know that that ancestor lives. When I play the drum, I know that ancestor lives when I tell the story. And it opens further because one of my teachers talks about the difference between kin and ancestors. And what he says is your kin are your departed, your dead, the names that you know and the people that you have loved. That is your kin. That is your dead. What he says that my ancestors, when he's referring to any of us, my ancestors are the faces I have never seen and the names I do not know. And what I am discovering is that you can learn those names and you can see those faces. And it's not symbolic. It is symbolic and it isn't symbolic. It's animated. It's real. Just as a symbol lives or it becomes a sign, so does the ancestral. So some of the work that I've done, deep memory process. I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Jungian analyst Roger Wolger. He cobbled together a training called deep memory process, where he uses active imagination and he uses some gestalt and he uses some body work, and he has cobbled together this way of letting the ancestor speak through you, letting the dead speak through you. And as Jungian analysts or people who are familiar with Jung, that's not all that unusual. When I was working as an analyst at one point, I had this man who would come to me, and I would get nauseous. I would get nauseous during the hour. And then he would leave, and I would be fine again. And so I think, oh, okay, maybe if I schedule him, you know, before lunch. And, you know, I'm doing all the things trying to figure out what this is, because it was a countertransference somatic reaction that I had never had so strongly before. So at one point I thought, you know, I tried rescheduling him and it didn't change. And so I thought, okay, well, what I'm going to have to do is I'm going to have to get what's the latest on somatic countertransference. So I Google somatic countertransference, and I get somebody's thesis from Pacifica, I believe. And Roger Wolger was mentioned as a reference, and I'd never heard of him. I'd never heard of his work, but I decided to explore it. So I started to explore it, and the nausea would lift. And I'd say, oh, yeah, but I don't have time for any more training, and the nausea would come back. And so I'd do a little bit more research, and, well, I can't afford it, and the nausea would return. So clearly I was to do some work around this. So I found out that, you know, when I first looked at the website, it looked like his work was in Brazil and in England, and I can't afford that, and I, you know, just finished my Jungian training, and if I bring that to my husband, he's going to divorce me, and et cetera, et cetera. And then I found out, oh, wait, he's offering a training in upstate New York. And it was called working with something about ancestral spirit work or something. It had ancestors in it. So, okay, I've got to go to that. So I set it up to go to it. And what I didn't realize was that on my way, as I was driving, I got so triggered by an ancestral complex that by the time I arrived at the workshop, I was already in a full-blown complex, but I didn't understand it. But I drove up to the place, and I just hated the building. God, it's ugly. Why am I here? I mean, I'm not the money I'm paying for this, and look at how ugly the building is, and they're giving me a little room. It looks like a nun cell, and, you know, I was really, you know, and, oh, look at the dust on the, you know, and that's so not me. I mean, I've got dust on my baseboards, but this is what I was in. But what I didn't realize is I was in a complex. And then we had our first meeting, and Roger is explaining what we're going to be doing over the next 4 or 5 days. And he quotes, he says he quotes Blake, but it's T.S. Eliot. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, you know, he's got an English accent, but he doesn't know T.S. Eliot from William Blake. I mean, how good can he be, you know? And I'm so in this complex, but again, not realizing it. And all the people that are there with me, oh, my God, like, oh, they all need to do some work. I should be handing out cards, you know? But I'm kind of, you know, I'm still there because I've paid the money, and so... And I'm thinking, oh, they're so out there, you know. People are talking about astrology, and people are talking about, you know, channeling and all these kinds of things. And so I decided that night when I went to bed that I was leaving. There's no question I'm leaving. I just need to decide, will I sneak out in the night when everyone's asleep? Or will I be, you know, a little bit more mature than that and call the organizers together at breakfast and say, thanks, but no thanks? Or will I go to the first session and tell all the participants that, you know, I'm out of here? So that's what I went to bed with. And then I had a dream. And the dream was so clear. This little girl, this little native girl came to me and said, help me. Help me. Help me. So I knew I was staying. And the work that I did that week was to learn her story. And her story was of being in a residential school. And I don't know if you know what I mean when I'm talking about residential schools. I think that's also part of the American Indian tradition. Or not tradition. History. Tradition. And so her story was coming through the ancestral. And I had to tell her story. And I had to release the secret that that story held. And the work was phenomenal. So deep memory process was a way in. My indigenous traditions have many ways in, like I mentioned, the ghost dance. So there are so many ways in to the ancestral, but the ancestral is not just your kin. It's not just your dead. It's also certain spirits or certain energies that feel a resonance to the work that you do. And that was the case with this little girl. And the story was that she had, when I was a little girl growing up near Six Nations, I used to go and sit under the bridge at Mohawk Creek, and I used to, you know, no one understood me, and I was clearly switched at birth, and who is this family, and they're not my people, and I used to write poems and float them down the river, and I had a dream that somewhere down the river they were being picked up and they were being read, and this sense was that she was a spirit who had attended the residential school and had died there. And so my loneliness had a resonance with hers. And so because I opened to the ancestral, because I was claiming my indigenous roots, I was able to be, as Leonard says, a conduit, the mere elaboration of a tube. All right, I see we're way over the time for a break, so perhaps that's a good time to take a break. Thank you. Sego Gananoa, we meet again, for surely we have met in the dream time, and surely we have met in those places between my words and what is stirring in you. And I thank you for what I'm seeing in your eyes as I look out at you, and what I'm seeing in your words or hearing in your words as you speak to me. So clearly the work is being done. What I'd like to do with this latter part of our time together here tonight is to give you something very practical that you can work with. I mean, I've told you these elaborate stories about working with Indigenous elders and working with Roger Wolger, who has since died. So if you're going to work with Roger, you're going to have to do it in the speaking to the dead. But what I'd like to do is I would like to give you some very practical things that you can introduce into your own lives and introduce them, to your clients or to your friends in terms of building what I would call a community of ancestors. Somebody asked me on the break about the interest in genealogy, and there's that wonderful phrase that there are no atheists in foxholes. And so my sense is that as we approach the end of our days in that last third of our lives, that we become interested in genealogy because they're coming forward to meet us. And so sometimes the interest in genealogy is because that energy is alive in the unconscious, because that energy is walking toward the door as we walk toward the door. I have a teacher that says that words go to the standard dictionary to die, and words go to the etymology dictionary to tell their stories. So I think the same is true with genealogy. To just know the names and the dates and who married who and who came where is a little bit like the standard dictionary. It's a beginning, but it's not the whole story. You know, that you have to then, you know, imagine and dream and begin to, you know, just intuit what is the story. And, oh, you know, you see that Frank married Josephine, and Josephine was clearly from elsewhere. So, oh, I wonder what that story is. And trust your imagination. What's that wonderful story where the man was seeing Jung for 5 years or something, and, you know, once a week, and telling his dreams, and at the end of the 5 years, the guy says to Jung, "I made them all up. Like, you know, joke's on you." And Jung's response was, "So? Where do you think they came from? You made them up. So? I can still, it still spoke of your unconscious whether you made them up or not." So I would encourage you to trust that as you imagine, as you tell the stories of these people that come to you in your dreams. I have done a lot of work with ancestral dreaming to the point where someone brings me in a dream and it's like I can hear when it's ancestral, because it has a different tone to it. It has a different quality to it. Whether it's the countertransference in me, I'm not sure. But I can hear the difference. And so that doesn't mean we can't work with it in a classical Jungian way. But if someone is open to it, there is also the opportunity to begin to explore it as an ancestral dream, and then to begin to explore what that might be asking of them. So what I'd like to do now, if we click to the next slide, I'm going to give you some practicalities for becoming an ancestor worth coming from. Because that's really what I'm encouraging. I want you to be good ancestors. You know, I want someday, you know, that people will gather and they'll tell your story and they'll talk about how you worked for a time that you will never see. You know, and that you polish those stones so that you didn't leave behind just, you know, things in the path for your descendants to stumble upon, but that you actually really did the work for the future. You know, someone said, you know, what kind of earth are we leaving to our children? I think this is the president of Brazil, and he said, no, that's not the question. We don't ask what kind of earth we're leaving to the children. We ask what kind of children are we leaving to the earth. You know, the place of influence is in who we are and the legacy we leave. So are we raising children that will be stewards of the planet? You know, not from, it's a subtle change, but it really asks something different of us. So to become an ancestor worth coming from, the first thing is ceremony. So I'm going to just give you a little bit of Indigenosity 101 here. Tomorrow we're going to attempt ceremony. And there is a difference between ceremony and ritual in my understanding. That ritual is what you do. And ceremony is what becomes of what you do. So the ceremonial is the very foundation of a life that is open to the ancestral, because ceremony feeds the ancestors. It's not for you. It's for them. And ritual does not feed the ancestors. Maybe it makes you feel good. And that's not a bad thing. There's nothing wrong with ritual. But it's not the same as ceremony. So when we talk about ceremony, we talk about setting the framework for something unexpected and mysterious and unknown to enter. A good analytical hour is a ceremony. You know, you have the ritual of how you meet at the door and who sits in what chair and how you present the dream. So you have the ritual. But the ceremony, and you know if you've sat in either chair or even, you know, heard of somebody sitting in either chair, you know the moment it becomes a ceremony. And, so, you know, whether it's a synchronicity or whether it's just a tone of voice as that dream is being explained, or the laughter you have when the image of the dream, you know, and then I opened the cupboard and the garbage spilled all over the kitchen floor. And just because of what they were talking about before they presented that dream, boom, and then you know that something has shifted and that understanding has come in. So we're going to attempt ceremony tomorrow. And I say attempt because it's not up to me. Ceremony involves participation. Those of you who have signed up for tomorrow, the ceremony has begun with you because you've already given it. You've set the day for yourself, you know, that I'm going to be available, and you've paid the money and you've got the babysitter or you've got somebody walking your dog, or you've already set the parameters to open up to the possibility of ceremony. Now, you can certainly come and have a ritual. There will be things I do and things we do, and at the end of the day, we can say, well, that was a lovely ritual. But I'm inviting you, I'm inviting them, that here the ancestors have called us together and they expect great things. They expect us to say what we mean and to live the hard path. And if we're lucky, we will have a ceremony. And in order for there to be a ceremony, there always has to be the possibility of failure, or it's not a ceremony. I remember one time being given the responsibility of conducting ceremony from my teacher, and there was five young women being initiated in an initiation lodge, and then I was the elder that stood at the in-between place. And so for 4 days, I was the only one that had contact with the girls as they were in the lodge and the village. So I would have contact with the village, and I would have contact with the girls, and I lived at that place of the crone, the place of the in-between, and it's a very lonely place. Talk about a training for being an elder. That was really a training ground for being an elder. And in fact, it was my initiation into what being an elder means. And one of the tasks that I was to do was when they were called Daughters of Soul, when the Daughters of Soul came out of the hut with the Mothers of Soul, that I would conduct a sweat for them so that they would be cleansed and purified before they returned to the village. And so the last thing the ceremonial leader said to me before I went on that Sunday morning, he said, okay, Muriel, what you need to know, here are the pearls. A true ceremonial leader knows what to do when everything goes to shit. And so that's what a ceremony is, when you know what to do when things aren't going according to your plan. So I'm inviting you tomorrow to ceremony, but I'm inviting you even more so to have a life of ceremony, you know, where you find those rituals that are important to you, and you don't make it a, I have to meditate every morning at sunrise, and that can be a discipline, but that's not a ceremony. That can be a ritual, but that's not a ceremony. Ceremony is when you allow, if something happens and it's co-opted in a different way, that you accept the meaning that you're seeking through the meditation or through the prayer or through the yoga or through whatever you're doing, that what is being introduced there is the possibility of ceremony. And you open yourself to that. So that is the very foundation, is ceremony. So to a group at the Seattle Young Society, I don't imagine that that's much of a stretch for you. I'm kind of preaching to the choir. You know that already. The next part is gift giving. We do not know how to give gifts in this culture. We have this premise of even Stephen, exchange. If I give you a gift, then you better give me a gift. Or even if I don't say that, I think that. Or worse, you give me a gift and I don't have one to give to you. And then the guilt of that. What gifting is in the indigenous way is you give what you cannot afford to give, or it's not a gift. I was gifted with this blanket long before I had earned the blanket. I couldn't believe it when it was gifted to me. It was like, well, why? And what I was told was the meaning will show itself. Why you were gifted this blanket, I don't know. But I was told to gift you this blanket. And I had to earn the blanket. I had to act according to the debt that gift incurred. So when you give somebody a gift, you are actually asking them to carry the burden of your generosity, the burden of your abundance. And if you completely just, give back in return, then there's no burden, is there? In the indigenous tradition, community or village is built on indebtedness, not on equality, not on even Stephen. Because if I borrow your lawnmower and we keep it even Stephen, then you have to borrow something from me. Or I keep track of how many times you borrowed my lawnmower. And you might not think you're operating in that way, but unconsciously or under the surface, that's exactly what's happening. Where in an indigenous community, you lose track. You lose track of whose lawnmower it is. Well, probably you wouldn't be using a lawnmower, so a bad example. But I think you know the idea. So it's not giving what you can afford to give, because that's not a gift. It's giving what costs you to give. And asking the person you gave to carry your indebtedness. And it's uncomfortable. It is uncomfortable to carry the indebtedness of a gift you did not deserve, that you did not earn. So that when you receive it, you say, this is too much. I can't carry this. Yet I will, because I trust that you have given me this because you want there to be a bond between us. And that gift is the bridge. And if the burden gets to be too much, then maybe I give to somebody else, not to you. Because if I give back to you, I've done the even Stephen thing and there is no indebtedness. But if I give then to somebody else, do you see how that moves? So the indebtedness grows and that sense of community grows. So gift giving is essential to the ancestral legacy or to carrying the ancestors, because they want us to be indebted to them. And we must be indebted to them. We must be indebted to their stories and to their sufferings and into their gifts. And until we learn how to give gifts, I don't think we can really be open to that. It's like, okay, I'm going to tap into my ancestors because I want their wisdom. That's just consumerism of another kind, a kind of a spiritual consumerism. So gift giving is very important. One of the things I had hoped to ask, and I forgot to. So if any of you are coming tomorrow, you're going to get the heads up on anyone who is not here who is coming tomorrow. And I'm going to ask that you bring three small gifts. Three small gifts. And that's all I'm going to say, because if I tell you what it was for, then that will determine what gifts you select. So the ceremony begins when I say, I'd like you to bring three small gifts. Now, there might be some people who come tomorrow that are going to learn that, and they're going to have to scramble out on their lunch hour to find three small gifts. So you've got the heads up. That's my gift to you. I know it's too much to carry, isn't it? I mean, you're so indebted to me. So pillar of this pyramid or this triangle is feed the dead. You know, the dead are hungry. And if we don't feed them, is it any surprise that they feed on us? So if you're haunted by an ancestral legacy, or you're haunted, it's because there are hungry ghosts. We feed the dead so that they are nourished by our words and by our actions, and then they do not feed on us. They can rest because we have fed them. And there are very simple ways to do that. The eloquence of your language is a way in which you feed the dead. When you speak of your loved ones, that feeds them. You know, it's like, did I just hear my name? You know, I've been dead 30 years and they're still talking about me. I'm going to just dip down a little bit closer and hear what they're saying. Now, that doesn't mean you just, you know, give them, you know, chocolate cake. I mean, sometimes Brussels sprouts are the story, you know, and they're a little bitter, but that's the story. So we need to feed the dead. One of the ways that you can do that, and one of the ways that we do it in my family, is that we have a little spirit bowl. And so that when we sit down to eat, you just put a tiny little morsel in the spirit bowl. And you do that before you eat. So what you're doing by that action is you're saying that someone and something has died so that I might live. And whether it's the chicken, or whether it's the broccoli, or whether it's the ancestors who, you know, died to bring me to this continent, that you're feeding them. And then what we do is that at some point after the meal, you take that little spirit bowl and you go out and you speak to the dead. And you say something like, you know, perhaps this chicken wasn't raised in a totally loving way, and I don't know its story because I bought it at the supermarket, and would be a time when I know the story of the chickens, because if I didn't raise them, I know who did. But this is the best that I have to offer. And so although my best isn't good enough, I offer it. And I hope that you will be fed by this offering, and that you will be at rest, and that you will know that you are not forgotten. And so in that way, you feed the dead. So there are many ways and many traditions in which you can feed the dead. What you are doing is you are remembering. You are remembering. And that's what one of my teachers says is the terror that he sees in the eyes of the dying, that they don't know how they will be remembered. They don't know what stories will be told. And that's the terror. You know, being afraid of death is not, it's not human. It's prevalent in this culture, but it's not human. If it were human, it wouldn't be happening. It would be the same everywhere, and it's not. That there are cultures who are not afraid of death, because they know death well. You know death when you put that little spirit offering, because you are remembering in that moment that something has died so that you might live. And then you walk with that, and you act accordingly. You live accordingly. You know, you honor the sacrifice by the way in which you live. So that's what living a ceremonial life is like. That's what being a gift culture is like. That's what feeding the dead and walking with the dead is like. And if you can do that, money back guarantee, you will become an ancestor worthy of coming from. And that's what I'm working toward. That's what I hope you're working toward, and that's why you're here. I'd like to read from one of my teachers, Stephen Jenkinson. He's written this dear little booklet called How It Could All Be. And he has a prayer at the end of it that I would like to read to you and to those who came with you and to those who had been forgotten. I make a prayer now to your old ones, to those whose face you never saw and voice you never heard and name you haven't known, that they remember you while you try to find them remembering you, that they come at the proper time to gather you in, that they come at the proper time to gather you in, that they whisper to you the truth that you haven't been alone. You haven't been alone. And you won't be. That they know the hard friendship of the ending of days. I make a prayer that all who were there at your making will be there for your gathering in. That their hands will be there just by your opening head, your little fountain, to make a home for your sorrowing heart and for you. I make a prayer that your house and your people will be blessed by your coming and your going. That the day will come when they will boast of having for a while known you, and that they will marvel at the way of your going out from among them, and that you might be the reason enough for them to continue a while, and that in the days to come, you will be claimed as noble, as an ancestor worthy of coming from. Stephen Jenkinson, he wrote this in British Columbia in 2009. Very close to here. Yeah, I think so. Recently in my community, one of us was, not one, I'm going to say one of us because she was a woman, but she was in a younger stage of her life for sure, in that she was ripe with babe. And we gathered as a community, and it was the most profound shower I have ever been to. I've been to many showers, baby showers, you know, and you play, no, okay, guys, I'm going to let you in on a secret here. You play these really lame shower games, and, you know, everybody hates it, but, you know, you want to be there because you want to somehow honor that something important is coming into the world. But this was a shower like no other, and that what each woman was asked to do was to hold their hands on her belly and to speak to Umtoto Umdogo. Umtoto Umdogo means little one becoming. and to speak to Umtoto Umdogo and to court the ancestors. Not to speak of the ancestors, but to speak to them and say, oh, Umtoto Umdogo, they love you and they want to keep you. But I'm going to speak to them and I'm going to ask the old ones to let you come to us and that we are worthy of your coming and that we will make a place for you. And we ask the ancestors who do these things that you be knitted up with five fingers and five toes on each hand and each foot and that you have a strong heart and you have a workable brain and that you will be able to run. And we ask this of the old ones. And should they send us you in any way that is compromised, in any way that is damaged, in any way that is not what we would consider complete, we promise that we will seek to know the meaning of that and that we will walk with it and that we will be with you. And so we're courting the old ones to let this one go. And it was so incredible. And then when she was born, when Ella May came to us, then we spoke to the ancestors to ask them to let her stay, and that we had kissed her cheek and we knew her beauty and that we wanted her to stay with us. And so there is a way in which we can be with the ancestors where they become part of our living and they enrich and deepen our lives. And it's not the same as talking of them. It's talking to them. So we're going to try to do some of that tomorrow. We're going to do tomorrow what in my traditions is called a Jibe ceremony. And it's a ceremony to feed the dead. And we are going to make prayer bundles and we're going to speak to our dead. And we're going to invite them to be fed by our words and fed by our actions. So for those of you coming, I've invited you to wear ceremonial regalia if you have it. By that I mean if you have some race tradition or faith tradition that has certain good-looking clothes, that would be the time to wear it. So, but if you don't, then you might just dress as if. You know, so put on your finest. There is a teaching that says a rich man can wear everything he owns to one event. So it's like, you know, that's a good jacket because it's the only one he's got. So I'm going to invite you to make that part of your ceremony, make that part of how you're gathering. And if you're not coming tomorrow, just consider doing that anyway and joining us wherever you happen to be tomorrow and become part of the ceremony, and we will feel the presence of your absence and that we will know that you were with us tonight and that we will feel your absence tomorrow. I'm asking you to bring three small gifts, as I've indicated. We're going to make what's an ancestral offer. So if you have something now, the ancestral offering is not one of the three small gifts. So if you would like to bring a picture of someone particular that you feel is calling to you or needing to be spoken to or needed to be spoken of, and you will not have to share that other than just placing it up, other than just. You. My teacher is telling me to take just out of my words because when you say, well, it's just going to be, you somehow have diminished it. I'm going to ask you to place it on the altar. You will not have to give it away. You will not have to speak to why you've brought it if you don't want to. And then I do have the black and white cloth and the rainbow ribbons and the tobacco. We are going to make prayer ties. So there will be part of the ceremony tomorrow where you will be reflecting and praying and being with what's coming through to you. I encourage you that if you have any dreams tonight as a result of our having met, please bring them and there will be a place for them. In Indigenous lodges, we don't move without finding out if there's a dream to guide us. So, boy, imagine what life would be like if that were the case. You imagine going to work on Monday morning in the corporate office and say, okay, who's got the dream for the week? You know, who's got the dream that we need to guide us? But that's really how it's done in the ceremonial lodges. So the protocol for tomorrow will be that we will set the altar, make the prayer ties. The grand entry means that's when it's ceremony proper. So we will gather at, I think it's at 10 o'clock, and we will be preparing for ceremony. And the ceremony proper will occur when we have prepared, so when we know it's time. And so that will be, and then there will be a certain element of gifting, hence the three small gifts. Okay, so I will be explaining more about what that's like.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.